Hello, KKFI listeners, and welcome to Trans Talk, this week's edition of the 10th Voice. I'm Una Nowling, and I'm here with my co-hostess, Fiona Nowling. Behind the board today is our sound engineer and producer, sitting in for Linda Wilson, Ebony Johnson. Hello, Ebony. We have two guests for today's show. First, we will be speaking with Julie, the mother of a transgender young man who is suing the Odessa School District in Missouri for over discrimination against her son. Next, we will be talking with Dr. Peter Raphael, a surgeon with the American Institute of Plastic Surgery, who serves the transgender male and female community, about his practice and developments in transgender surgery. I will finish up the show, Fiona will finish up the show with the community calendar update. But first, I'm going to take a look at some of the transgender news of the week. Not even 7 days after the disastrous election, the Veterans Administration has announced that they are withdrawing their plan to pay for gender confirmation surgery due to a lack of funding and an expectation that no funding will be available under a future Trump administration. As a result, the agency has officially withdrawn its rule change, leaving thousands of transgender veterans stranded without the ability to pay for their necessary transgender medical care. Because screwing over our veterans, my friends, is how some make America great again. This also raises a specter that active service personnel may very soon find that all funding for transgender medical care for them will be cut as well. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, there's just so much Trump influence, it's actually changing the way I speak. It's very bigly. A long-term hater of transgender persons says that one of his top priorities in the 2017 legislative year is to push through a so-called Women's Protection Act. While details of this vague and nebulous piece of legislation are scant, sources confirm it essentially is a sweeping transgender bathroom ban. And here I thought a Women's Protection Act would focus on doing things like actually protecting women, such as harsher penalties for rape and anti-rape legislation, mandating equal pay for women, and efforts to fight the rampant domestic violence situation in Texas. In other Texas news, State Senator Connie Burton, Connie is spelled with a K, has introduced a bill which would discipline teachers and other school employees if they withheld information about a student's sexual orientation or gender identity from that student's parents, in effect making it a criminal offense not to out LGBT students against their will, and thus creating an even chillier environment in the public schools of Texas. In Minnesota, concerned parent Anne Marie Calgaro has actually held a full court press conference to announce her intention to sue a 17-year-old who is seeking gender transition. Who is this 17-year-old who threatens the very fabric of Christendom and the immortal soul of Ms. Calgaro? Why, it's her very own child. Yes, this Mom of the Year candidate is claiming that transgender children, and especially her own, violate the civil rights of parents by taking control of their own health and bodies, even if they are legally emancipated. While some have claimed that the entire legal effort is actually an end-run challenge to an abortion rights law that protects the privacy of minors in that state, supporters of Ms. Calgaro claim that her legislation could be the bellwether for parents across the nation to protect them from the great Satan and clouds of sulfur, also known as transgender children. In local news, the principal of the Neiman Elementary School in the Shawnee Mission School District has banned faculty and staff from wearing safety pins to show solidarity against bigotry, discrimination, and violence. Principal Stan Anderson wrote that wearing a safety pin to protest bigotry and discrimination could upset students, as they would see it as a political statement against the president-elect. The district followed this up with a somewhat unusual and, I have to say, a little bit bizarre letter that claimed, in effect, that showing intolerance towards intolerance was not to be tolerated. Right now, in the afterlife, George Orwell is giving the school district a slow golf clap.
And if you wanted to give them a slow golf clap, they actually have an open school district board meeting on Monday the 28th of November, and it starts at 7 p.m. You need to get there slightly early if you wish to address the board so that you can register to speak.
Where is that at?
That's in the boardroom at 7235 Antioch Road.
Okay. Just if anybody felt the need to do that. We certainly can't say that anyone should actually go out and do that, because that would be a call for action. Some slightly good news from North Carolina, as Democratic candidate for Governor Roy Cooper, who has promised to reverse the anti-LGBT provisions of the notorious HB2 law. So many acronyms in this already. appears to be in the lead in the still deadlocked race. His opponent, the rabidly anti-transgender Pat McCrory, has promised to carry on a legal fight for as long as it takes, bravely standing tall against all those annoying and irritating rabble who actually think they deserve civil rights and equality. Do we have any other good news this week? Any at all? Let me look here. Not much in America. Nothing in the Southern Hemisphere. Oh, yeah. Here's a little bit of inane but news, but it's evidence of how transgender rights are advancing, at least somewhere in the world. I thought I would mention that in China, there is a weekly television program being hosted by a transgender woman that has achieved a viewership of 100 million viewers per show. Called the Oprah of China by some, Jin Xing is a 49-year-old transgender woman who is spreading awareness of transgender persons and our absolute need for equal rights throughout the most populous country on Earth. Although China has made several human rights advances on paper regarding transgender persons in the last 10 years, unofficially it is still hazardous to even admit you are transgender in Chinese society. That being said, the tsunami of bigotry seen in this last election has made me gaze from time to time at the Chinese visa in my passport that still says I have 9 years left on it to live and work in that country. Maybe I could work at a Chinese steel factory to build more Trump casinos and strip clubs to keep making America the greatest great that ever graded. I'm Una Nowling, and that was the transgender news of the week.
I'm Fiona Nalik, and because of my work leading a support group for significant others, friends, family and allies of transgender persons, I often hear about children and college students who aren't drinking water or other liquids and are risking dehydration, health issues and permanent damage because they are not comfortable using the restroom at school because of school policies. Even before the election, because of the court cases trying to reject Title IX coverage of transgender students' rights. With us today is a local mom, Julie, who has a transgender son who is a student in the Odessa School District. Because of discrimination there, Julie is suing them with the help of the ACLU. Julie, welcome to Trans Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your family?
I live in Odessa with my 5 children. The oldest one is 15, the youngest one is 6, with the 3 in the middle. Chance began telling us he was a boy when he was 18 months old. The first sentence he ever said to me was, "I am a boy." So we have been dealing with this or trying to figure out how to navigate this for his entire life.
How old is your son now?
He's 8.
So he's in the 3rd grade at school?
That's correct.
So what did you do when he first came out to you? Did you see therapists, or what was the path you took to go forward?
We started, when he was 3, we started seeing a therapist, mainly because I wanted to understand why he was saying what he was saying. He was always, even at the young age of 2 and 3, never wanted to wear girl clothes, always chose so-called boy things, clothes, toys, and we're pretty open parents anyway, so we were always letting him do that. But I wanted to start seeking therapy just to understand what was happening and why he kept saying and was so adamant about him being a boy.
And what did you have to do when he started school after that then?
He started kindergarten, and he was still recognized as female. And then the kindergarten year was very hard. He came home almost every day from school crying, saying that he didn't want to live, that nobody liked him, and that nobody would care if he died. And he was 5. So we started really seeking therapy, in part just to keep him alive. And quickly, we were told we need to acknowledge him. He will be one of the at-risk kids to kill himself or hurt himself or mutilate himself. And I made a decision, and his dad made a decision, that we're not going to bury our kid over a pronoun. So we started acknowledging him and changing our pronouns, and he was happy instantly.
And this was all around kindergarten, first grade?
This was all kindergarten, when he was really, really felt like nobody loved him.
When did you decide was the year to actually re-enter him into school, so to speak, under his true gender?
It was first grade, the very next school year. We went to the school, we met with the district personnel, we met with the counselors at the school, and they were very supportive at the time. That was his first grade year. We had the most amazing first grade teacher on the planet, and she was so wonderful to him. And things were better. The kids were better to him at school. The siblings were better to him. And I had a kid that was happy, that didn't talk about killing himself any longer.
Was there any reaction at all? I mean, even, was there any, did the teacher, as far as you know, make an announcement to the students, or did Chance just show up as Chance and everyone just adjusted to it and figured it out? How formal was the process with respect to Chance's peers?
I think we didn't make a formal announcement, but the teacher was amazing. She did these round table discussions on the carpet with the children, and said to the kids in the class, we're going to accept each other for what we are. And, you know, you may not be good at math and you may not be good at science, and we're okay with that. We accept you. And so she had a big thing where she made sure that Chance said, I want to be accepted as a boy. And she said, I accept you, and had the other kids say that we're going to support each other in that classroom.
That's really great.
She was amazing. She's an amazing teacher.
And it's an example to a lot of people who worry about how to explain about being transgender to their kids when someone in the family comes out to them.
It's been interesting to see my other children basically kind of just know he never fit as a female in the family, and now he's so much more accepted by the siblings.
That's really great. How is his father with it?
It's been a long road, but we're on board. He's on board with it. We all call him his name. We all call him by the pronouns he wishes to be called by. So we all had to take our own roads in my family. We all had to take our own journey to acceptance of this. And my ex-husband has been really quite amazing.
That's really nice to hear, especially with co-raising and co-parenting a child. So for those of our listeners who don't know, Odessa is a town of about 5,300 people that's about 30 miles east of here on I-70. Before we talk about the details of the current school issue, can you describe what the attitude or the demographic is where you live? Is it a very conservative area, or even an area that you're concerned about having your son transition in?
It's definitely conservative, but I think it's also such a small community that everybody tries to support as much as they can for what they understand. I've had some really good people in the community that have stood up for me. I've had other mothers go to the school and say, what can we do to help this family, to help Chance, to help them feel accepted?
Is there any... I don't know. Are you a religious family? And if so, have you had support from your clergy or had some pushback from them?
I was raised Catholic, and I haven't had any problems with anybody in the church or any religious, but I've also tried to stay really quiet. And I think by having to file a lawsuit, that's going to end. So we'll have to see what happens now that I have my name out there.
That's understandable. So everything was really great in the first grade. So tell me about the current issue with the school district, please.
So in Odessa, kindergarten, first, and second is in one building. Third, fourth, and fifth is in a different building with different administrators. And this year he went into third grade, and they were adamant that he is not allowed to use the bathroom. And they made sure that he knew he wasn't allowed to use the boys' bathroom. In second grade at the other building, he just decided to go to the boys' bathroom, and it was fine. And the teachers supported him. The kids were fine with it. But at this new school, it's been a real issue.
And it's particularly strange since he'd already been using the boys' bathroom with exactly the same students the year before.
And the students are so... Children have such an honest way to be in the world. And it's the adults can't let the children be children. They have to... I don't know if they're afraid. I don't know if they're trying to run an agenda. I don't understand why my son can't use the bathroom. So he was getting on the bus this year in August when school started. He would get on the bus at 7:15, get off the bus at 3:15, and not have used the bathroom for the entire day.
Yeah, that's painful, and it's, health risks as well.
It's so heartbreaking because they were forcing him to go to the nurse's bathroom. And he said to me, "Mom, if they make me go to the bathroom that's separate from everybody else, I don't know what to say because all the boys will be lined up and all my friends will say to me, 'Hey, Chance, come stand next to me. Chance, get in line with us. Chance, where are you going? Why do you use a separate bathroom?'" And he said, "I don't know what to say, Mom, so I just don't go to the bathroom at all." And he doesn't have the words of segregation or discrimination, but he knows that by forcing him to be separate, it makes him stand out more, and all he wants to do is go to the bathroom.
Have the school administrators actually given a reason or just denied with no explanation?
Their policy is that they are going to use, the children are going to use the bathroom of their birth gender. At school, they use the male pronouns. They use his name, his male name. But they are saying that they've passed this policy, which passed in 2015, by the way. And Chance has been in the school district for longer than that. So they passed a policy knowing they have transgender students in their district. And now they're saying to me, "We stand behind our policy."
But, and I assume that means they'll also make him use the girls' locker room for changing.
Yes, the policy states that he can use the bathroom of his, the bathrooms and the locker rooms of his birth gender, which, if he was a different kind of person, it would be interesting experiment to see, to send a known and accepted boy into the girls' bathroom and see what happens. But he's so genuine and so kind-hearted and so confused about why there's an issue that I can't send him to the girls' bathroom. And he himself has decided he's just not going to go to the bathroom at school.
So what did you do when you found out about this from the school?
I called the principal, and she told me that there's a policy, and they're going to stand behind it, and there's nothing she can do.
So then what was the next step from there?
And then she called the superintendent, and he called me. His name's Bob Brinkley. He called me, and he was very rude to me and very short with me over an issue. I was on the phone with the principal and the superintendent, and I was crying. And I was saying to them, "Everything I have fought for 2 years or more is to keep my kid alive. I am not going to bury my kid over a bathroom. And you guys, in the 2 days of school this year, they made him come home from school crying and saying, I don't want to go back. Nobody likes me. They hate me. Going back to what he was and how much he hated himself. And I'm trying to explain to these administrative people that they've undone all of this work that we have done to keep him alive. They've undone it in 2 days of school. And they just keep saying to me, well, we have a policy. We have a policy.
Yeah, not a good policy, but a policy.
A policy that was passed without even contacting the people who it affects.
Yeah.
That's the way it normally is. They don't want to hear from us, or they don't want to hear from transgender children and their parents, because my belief is at heart they don't even really see us as human beings.
It's awful, and it's so hard to have a child. And my son will, every time he comes home and he asks me, you know, can I use the bathroom yet, Mom? Well, let me call. And then he says to me, you told him I'm a boy. Yes, I told him you're a boy. They believe I'm a boy. They know I'm a boy, right? They know you're a boy. Why can't I go to the bathroom? I don't know why you can't go to the bathroom.
So after the superintendent and the principal blocked you like that, what was the next step?
I tried to get a board meeting. I tried to get on the next board meeting. So, and I wanted an open board meeting. I wanted everybody in the community to speak. I wanted my friends to speak. I have amazing friends. I'm surrounded by amazing people. And a lot of my friends wrote letters. They wanted to get on the agenda to speak. And they said to me, we're not going to put you on an open agenda board meeting. We're going to put you in a closed session off the record.
Wow. So no one could see what they did to you, and they could claim you were being unreasonable. I think we have an extra question from our producer, Ebony.
We have a question, actually, from a caller. Caller, you're on the air. Are you there?
Hi, I am. Hi, this is Michelle, and I'm in Overland Park, and I'm just driving, and I'm listening to this heartbreaking story. As a mother, I just feel for everything that you're going through.
There's a mute or something. I see the light here. But she did want to know, she was just says she was listening to the heartbreaking story. She's in Overland Park. And she'd like to know if there's, how can she help? Is there like a web page or something they can do to maybe contact schools? What can they do to help this situation in your case?
What I would really like is for the school district to know and our administrators to know that people aren't afraid of my son, and people aren't afraid to be in the bathroom with my son. And I'm sure that our administrative staff and Bob Brinkley would be happy to speak to her if she would like to call Odessa R7. And on their website is everybody's contact information for our district.
Do you have a GoFundMe or a public email address or something for people that may be interested in finding out more information?
I don't.
Because I know your next step after they just shut you down like that was that you decided to sue them for discrimination with the help of the ACLU, and that can't be cheap, even with the ACLU helping you.
It's going to be a struggle, but he's worth it. If I have to work two jobs, if I have to work three jobs, this child is worth the fight. And even when I went to my closed-door school board meeting, I was still not wanting to be public. But I went to this meeting with people who know my kids, people who coach them in soccer, people who are my neighbors, and was sobbing and telling my story to my school board, and they said not one word to me. They were silent. And I said, are you guys not allowed to speak to me? And the secretary shook her head no. So I was forced to go to a closed door discussion where nobody would speak to me. And I felt so disrespected and so hurt. And I felt like I had been slapped in the face. And the very next day, I was like, we're going to have to sue.
How did you go about that? And how did you go about getting support from the ACLU?
Luckily, I started working at a law firm here in town. And I went back to work the next day. And I said, I need your guys' help. Who can I contact? Who can help me? And one of our lawyers in the firm knew somebody at the ACLU.
We're running out of time, so I have one question, which is, what other advice would you give to other parents in the same situation as you?
I think that you need to listen to your children. It's not the end of the world. It's not going to cause any harm if you just believe in your children.
I want to say to our listeners that Julie doesn't have a public email, but if you would like to pass on some words of support or send her a message through us, you can send us an email at the10thvoice@gmail.com, and we can pass it on to her. That's thetenthvoice@gmail.com, and we can get the message to her.
Thank you, Julie, for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Hello and welcome back to Trans Talk. Ooh, a little bit of a hot mic there. let me give a little bit of an introduction for our next guest. You know, an important part of the transition process for many of us in our evolution is a medical process, both via hormones and surgery. And transgender surgery itself has gone through many evolutions over its history. Some of the first techniques were actually developed by surgeons to repair the genitals of wounded World War I soldiers, and slowly evolved through the era of such persons as Lily Elbe in the 1930s and Roberta Cowell and Michael Dillon in the 1940s. The transition to Christine Jorgensen in 1952 kicked off interest in transgender surgery in earnest, especially because of the enormous groundswell of transgender persons who came out of hiding to contact Dr. Christian Hamburger and the other doctors that worked on Ms. Jorgensen in Denmark. And the techniques kept developing over time through the lineage of Dr. Georges Barou of Casablanca and Dr. Stanley Biber of Trinidad, Colorado, and then to the present day, which some call either the fourth or fifth generation of transgender surgery. We are fortunate to have joining us by phone today Dr. Peter Raffel of the American Institute for Plastic Surgery in Plano, Texas, to talk about surgery for both transgender men and women. Welcome to Trans Talk, Dr. Raffel.
Thank you. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Okay, we can hear you just a little bit here. Let me go ahead and try to see what we can do and ask you how you got started in the era of transgender surgery.
Okay, I performed my first transgender-related procedure approximately 25 years ago. And in private practice in Plano, Texas. And since that time, I've very steadily increased the number of patients that I have seen to the point that now I perform approximately 400 gender-related surgeries per year. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you. About how many patients, what would be your typical patient breakdown between transgender men and transgender women?
Well, it's probably half and half, to be honest. Perhaps it's 60% men and 40% trans women. Early in my practice, I saw a preponderance of transgender males, and now I'm getting closer and closer to a 50-50 mix. So we see quite a bit of both and quite a variety of surgery. One of the interesting things that we are seeing is a much younger patient population than we used to. It's interesting because now what we're seeing is a lot of transgender males in their even their early teens. So we're starting to see as young as 12 years old, we've done several at that age for top surgery. Obviously, we prefer to sort of defer lower surgery until they're over 18. But as far as top surgery, we're starting to see quite a few teenage trans boys from really all over the world, even in as far as Japan, Australia, the Middle East. So it's becoming a much more accepted sort of practice to intervene earlier, even from a surgical standpoint.
And I understand you have a special procedure where you a special procedure and no drain technique and a keyhole surgery technique for working with top surgery?
Yes, approximately 6 years ago, we developed a drainless technique for performing top surgery. As most people, or certainly trans men know, the typical procedure involves bilateral mastectomies with placement of drains that stay in for approximately 1 week. Now, everyone who's had one knows that those drains are painful. They can be fraught with problems such as infection. They can come out. We've seen all sorts of crazy stories, dogs chewing them in half, all sorts of things. So what we did, we adapted techniques that we use for other surgeries to the chest surgeons to the point where we quilt down the flaps and are able to do these procedures with a complete drainless approach, which we've done it now in over 500 patients just in the last 3 years alone with a drainless technique and have not had to take a single patient back to surgery for hematoma. So it's been a very effective technique.
Now, you mentioned that you've also been working on bottom surgery, so to speak, for transgender men. I understand that's one of the most complicated transgender surgeries that can be done, correct?
That is correct. You know, there are two paths, obviously, that transgender men can sort of take, if you would. One is the metoidoplasty type of route. The other is the phalloplasty type of route. They're both very, very different. There are 180-degree differences in the approach and also the mindset of the patient who chooses one or the other. So one of the things that we always say is the most important decision with regards to bottom surgery for a trans man is to decide which way am I going. Am I going left for the metoidoplasty route, or am I going right or a phalloplasty route? Because they're very, very distinctly different. Now, I do not perform the phalloplasty. I just do not have the time to add that to our repertoire, but we have developed techniques for the modified metoidoplasty that we call a centurion procedure, where we basically take and reroute the round ligaments into the neophallus to add more girth. So that is the technique that we prefer to use. We typically will do that in a staged approach where we first build the neophallus with the round ligaments. We build the neoscrotum, place the testicular implant, and do a mucosal vaginectomy if the patient has already undergone a total hysterectomy. Then we come back 6 months or later and complete the urinary rerouting, or the hookup as commonly.
Very good. We need to take a brief break for a station announcement, and then we'll come right back to you, and I want to ask you some questions about surgical techniques for transgender women. Thank you very much, Dr. Raphael.
Thank you.
This is Diana Lynn, volunteer and DJ at your community radio station, 90.1 FM. Giving Tuesday is a global day of giving fueled by the power of social media and collaboration. Celebrated on the Tuesday following Thanksgiving, Giving Tuesday kicks off the charitable season when many focus on their holiday and end-of-year giving. This year, on Giving Tuesday, November the 29th, I'm asking you to join the Giving Tuesday movement and give to 90.1 FM. Your donation is tax-deductible. It's a simple idea and easy to do. You can donate securely online at kkfi.org. Click the donate button. Or join us on Facebook at 90.1 FM KKFI. Click the donate button. It's that easy. Giving Tuesday, November 29th.
Jaws of Justice Radio investigates how we can achieve justice from a system of laws deeply rooted in economic, political, and social inequality. We strive to dispel misconceptions created by the news and entertainment industries, as well as the fear-mongering of the political system. Listen in as we search out the tools needed to make our community a more just environment. Jaws of Justice Radio, Mondays at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Hello and welcome back to Trans Talk. We're fighting some strange technical gremlins. I, of course, blame Donald Trump that are causing us a little bit of difficulty getting our very special guest on the air today. But I believe he's still on with us. Dr. Raphael, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to ask you some questions about surgery for transgender women, and I wanted to sort of start at the top, so to speak, and breast augmentation, which is something I did a lot of research on myself as a lay person, having gone through the procedure last year. Can you tell me a little bit about the techniques that you use for a top surgery for transgender women?
Yes. With transgender women, as with all women, we absolutely prefer the placement of the implant to be subpectoral, or what we term behind the muscle. Now, there are some different approaches, and that's fine. Everyone has an opinion on how they like to approach it. But we definitely prefer the implant placed behind the muscle on all women, whether it's a cis woman or a trans woman, because we feel it gives a much more natural look to the breast and the contour of the chest. And we're able to put whatever size implant behind the muscle. We do a little bit more of release of the medial, what we call the inner aspect of the muscle, to give a little better cleavage in many cases. But really, we don't adjust otherwise too much than we would on a cis woman when we are performing top surgery or breast augmentation on a trans woman. So really, it's the same procedure under the muscle, and we strongly prefer silicone implants, which are the new, what they call, they're cohesive. It's like the gummy bear type of implant that you hear described quite often. So it's a very safe implant. It has a much more natural feel than the saline, and it's our preferred implant of choice for all women, as a matter of fact.
Now, I have to say, when I was trying out implants, when my surgeon gave me some samples of the gummy bear implants, they seemed very, very hard. Is that, are there different types or subtypes of that type of implant?
There are. And there are, in other words, the gummy bear implant is really not a technical term, obviously.
Correct.
It was a term coined with one brand of implant. But in reality, all implants are quote-unquote gummy bear in appearance. In other words, any silicone implant on the market is made from cohesive silicone, meaning you can cut an implant in half and it's not going to leak out all over the table, sort of like Jell-O, if you would. It's fairly contained. And so all implants are that style. Now, we don't use the harder gummy bear implant that you're probably describing. I prefer to use the brand of Mentor, which is actually the only implant that is manufactured in the United States. It's a Johnson & Johnson company, and we just feel very good about the quality and the company that stands behind that implant. So that is the implant I prefer to use, unless a woman really insisted on another type of implant.
Now, I noticed that... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please continue.
Okay. I noticed on your website that you highlight that you do orchiectomy procedures, which is something that, you know, I get a lot of interest in. I field a lot of questions being an activist with people in the community trying to give them information or connect them up with folks. You know, as there's only one surgeon in the Kansas City area, as far as I know, that even does this procedure. And I guess the first question I was wondering is, why would a transgender woman choose to have an orchiectomy instead of full GRS?
Okay, that's a wonderful question. First of all, we perform a lot of GRS as well on trans women, and so we offer both procedures. A orchiectomy is done in several situations. One is where it may be done initially for financial reasons. For example, a trans woman who is on testosterone blockers, having a tough time with it, and really wants to get off of that, may choose to do an orchiectomy just to reduce the testosterone load on her body. Because she may not financially be able to afford GRS for several years, or just isn't at a point in her life that she can afford the time off for GRS surgery. So that's one setting where we very often perform GRS, and then we may come back 2 or 3 or 4 years later and perform the GRS surgery. Now, there are also some cases, as you can imagine, where a woman exists in a partnership. It may be her wife, who was her wife at the time that was still presenting as male, is not completely on board with the full transition immediately and wants to take it in steps. And that's a scenario where we often will see a woman choose the orchiectomy first to sort of live without the testosterone, not having, you know, to take the blockers and, you know, the spironolactone, and may choose that for several years, see how it goes with her partner, and then if all goes well, may continue forward. So everyone has their own reasons. I even have some women who choose to stop at the point of orchiectomy in the transition. As we know, it's not a, certainly we don't have a binary world, and even in the world of trans, it's certainly not binary. So there are many people that are comfortable along that continuum that doesn't necessarily have to culminate in full GRS surgery.
A frequent question that people have when we talk about orchiectomy is, there is, you know, the thought that if you have an orchiectomy, it limits or may even prevent GRS later on due to shrinkage of the skin. Is that true or false?
Absolutely false. I've performed many GRS procedures on women who've had previous orchiectomy or that I've done orchiectomies on. It doesn't hamper whatsoever. It may look like it's shrunk, but once you take that skin and you stretch it out, It is absolutely there. As a matter of fact, I performed a GRS surgery about a week ago on a patient that I had performed orchiectomy on 4 years before. And I actually had too much skin, if you would, the scrotal skin, that I didn't even need to use at all for the deep vaginal reconstruction. So we have no issues at all performing GRS subsequent to previous orchiectomy.
Too much skin is really, it's almost kind of humorous. I have a friend who, when she met her GRS surgeon, said he jumped up and down happy as a clam because he found out that she hadn't been circumcised.
Right, and that does help, no question. So at the end of the day, whether we're dealing with a trans man or a trans woman, what we build has material toolbox, if you want.
Yes. I have
but
one.
Orchiectomy doesn't impede it.
I had one final question here before we have to let you go, and I appreciate talking to you very much, and I apologize for the technical difficulties. But I wanted to know, in terms of transgender women, what sort of procedures, or how many transgender women have you treated in your practice for bottom surgery?
Well, we see, like I said, I personally see about 400 patients a year, so about 200 trans women for various procedures, whether it's top
surgery, bottom surgery. We do quite a bit of facial feminization surgery. So we see a pretty wonderful mix. We just started performing the bottom surgery about 5 or 6 years ago. So we currently perform maybe about 30 to 40 to maybe 50 of those per year.
That's incredible. And a lot of folks aren't even really aware that we have a GRS surgeon that closely linked to Kansas City and to a local transgender institute. I want to thank you very much for joining us on Trans Talk today, Dr. Rafael. And again, I apologize for the technical difficulties, but I'd like to have you back on a later show here soon, if you don't mind.
I'd love to. It's an honor. Just let me know, and I wish you all the very, very best.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Yes, ma'am. Happy holiday.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Fiona Nowling with the Kansas City Community Calendar. Every month, I lead the Kansas City Sofa Group for significant others, friends, family, and allies of transgender persons. We meet on the first and third Wednesday of the month. This month, we are having a special joint meeting with UMKC Trans Plus Allies Group on December 7th for their family roundtable in the UMKC Student Union, room 402, starting at 6 p.m. On December 21st, SOFA will be back on our usual schedule at 6:30 in Study Room 116 at Leawood Pioneer Library. For driving directions and other SOFA information, you can visit transitcity.org/SOFA. That's with two Fs. There is an FTM support group at the Transgender Institute on the first and third Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. That's at 8080 Ward Parkway, Kansas City, Missouri. And there is also an M2F support group, but the dates and times of that are changing. So if you're interested, contact the Transgender Institute on 816-305-0943. And just seeing that I said that backwards, the Tuesday support group is MTF. It's for trans women. I said it exactly backwards. And if you're interested in the FTM support group, you need to call to get the times and dates. And on December 10th, the Transfinity KC Chorus will have their Christmas concert, Singing for Peace, at 7 p.m. at Country Club Congregational United Church of Christ. That's at 205 West 65th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. And for information on tickets, you can visit transfinitykc.org. A transgender support group organized by Dr. Hitt and Sony will run the first and third Saturday of the month from 1 to 2:30 p.m. The group is open to all transgender persons, allies, and family members. The address is 901 Kentucky Avenue, Suite 303, Lawrence, Kansas. And we're out of time for the calendar for this month, so I will be putting details about it on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/10thvoice. I'm Fiona Nowling, and that's the community calendar for the upcoming month.
Well, thank you for tuning in to Trans Talk, this week's edition of the 10th Voice, and thank you, brave listeners, for battling with this through several technical gremlins. I've never actually seen a soundboard on fire before, but you know there's always a first time for everything. Many thanks to our special guests, Julie and Dr. Rafael, and our sound engineer and producer, Ebony Johnson. Remember that you can always send an email with your thoughts and suggestions to the10thvoice@gmail.com. Next up, stay tuned for This Way Out, followed by Wings, and then Every Woman with Sharon Lockhart, Amy Bell, and I presume Ebony Johnson as well for that. She's nodding her head yes as she's putting out the flames. And be sure to join the 10th Voice next weekend as well on Saturday at 1 p.m. for more discussion of LGBT topics and events which shape our lives and our world. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.